Power Lens just won the award for Best Feature at the 2022 American Documentary and Animation Film Festival. For more of our coverage on the climate catastrophe and the indigenous struggle to protect the Earth, well, every day is Earth Day here at Democracy Now! Go to democracynow.org. Oh, we have an immediate job opening for a news writer-producer. Go to democracynow.org for more information and apply immediately. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website, at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up this spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, a former Oregon Health Authority worker faces charges for stealing $1.5 million. President Biden stops by the Pacific Northwest, and awareness about the dangers of forever chemicals grows on Earth Day. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 22nd, 2022. KBOO is in our spring membership drive, and now is a great time to support your community radio station by going online to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. I'm Josh Salem. A former employee of the Oregon Health Authority is facing criminal charges for embezzling around $1.5 million from federal COVID funds. Marzia Abedin was hired by the Health Authority as a program analyst to help process invoices for services related to vaccination efforts. The Department of Justice found that Abedin created a fake catering company that was invoicing the health authority. They were tipped off by inconsistencies in the invoices, which listed dates and places where vaccination events never happened. Abedin faces 21 counts of theft, forgery, identity theft, aggravated theft, and computer crimes, among others. The Department of Justice recovered a majority of the money that Abedin allegedly embezzled, and there is a warrant for her arrest. Joe Biden made his first presidential trip to the Pacific Northwest yesterday. He arrived at the Portland Air National Guard Base near Portland International Airport early Thursday afternoon. The official reason for Biden's visit was to discuss infrastructure. The White House said last week that Biden would speak about, quote, his administration's efforts to continue bringing down costs for American families in growing our clean energy economy, end quote. Portland has not had a president visit since Barack Obama stopped here in 2015. Biden himself also visited 1 year earlier when he was vice president. The president's speech aimed at building support for the $1 trillion infrastructure package he signed into law last year. The act will provide billions of federal dollars to Oregon and Washington. Washington is expected to receive about $1.8 billion for road projects from the infrastructure package, while Oregon will get $1.2 billion over 5 years. The speech specifically mentioned investments to help Portland International Airport run more efficiently, including an upgrade to make one of the airport's two runways seismically resilient. Biden also discussed the Interstate Bridge Replacement Program, which is aimed at the I-5 bridge over the Columbia River. Biden was in town for about 4 hours, arriving around 12:40 p.m. and then giving the infrastructure speech at the airport at around 2:30 p.m. He departed for Seattle at 4:40 p.m. Biden also attended a fundraising event at the Portland Yacht Club, which is near the airport along Northeast Marine Drive. Health effects from forever chemicals, or PFAS, have received more media attention in recent years as scientists learn more about their serious impacts. Government regulators face pressure to take action to test for their presence in drinking water and to limit PFAS in everyday products. Mike Moen has more on the story in North Dakota.
Compared to other states, North Dakota hasn't seen a lot of documented water contamination from forever chemicals known as PFAS. Residents who suspect there may be exposure in their community are urged to follow up. The Center for Health, Environment, and Justice recently hosted a discussion to encourage grassroots efforts to address suspected contamination. Policymakers and scientists are paying more attention to health risks tied to these human-made compounds found in many consumer products and firefighter foam. Andrea Amico, a leading community activist from New Hampshire, says for those thinking about getting involved, there are ways to make your voice heard.
Testifying at government hearings on PFAS, attending and presenting at national conferences, participating in exposure assessments and health studies.
Amico became involved after her family was impacted by highly contaminated drinking water near a former Air Force base in her state. Firefighting foam was used in training there. In 2020, North Dakota collected samples from dozens of water systems, yielding 3 minor detections, but there are concerns with soil contamination reported at sites like Fargo's Air National Guard base. In addition to military sites, Amico says people living in industrialized areas and near landfills should be aware of what's potentially lurking in their groundwater. The national coalition she's involved with has established goals in protecting communities around the country.
We want to work towards regulation of PFAS as a class, and we want it at 1 part per trillion or less, as we feel that is the most protective standard for communities.
She says some of the challenges include navigating the multiple layers of communication and reaching out to regulators and elected officials. And while the military funded cleanup of the former site near her home, Amico says those examples are rare. The federal infrastructure law approved last year did include $10 billion to address PFAS contamination nationwide. Mike Moen, Prairie News Service.
Energy-efficient homes can actually better the health of their residents. Well-sealed and well-ventilated homes tend to have better air quality. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Home energy efficiency upgrades can cut carbon pollution and help people save money on utility bills. But for Kevin Kennedy, director of the Environmental Health Program at Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City, Missouri, there's an even bigger payoff.
Really, it's the health benefit and the long-term outcomes for the people living in the home that, in my mind, matter most.
For more than 20 years, Kennedy has helped families identify and address environmental health hazards in their homes. For example, mold, dust, and dander can trigger asthma attacks, which send about 1 million children in the U.S. to the emergency room each year. He says some of the steps that can eliminate these hazards are the same steps people can take to improve their home's energy efficiency. Adding insulation and sealing leaks can help reduce moisture. Improving heating and ventilation systems can decrease indoor dust and pollen.
It makes significant changes in how air flows and circulates through the house, where that air comes from, and the quality of that air.
So he says helping families make their homes more energy efficient can also reduce global warming, cut costs, and keep families safe and healthy. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
The Treasury Secretary warns against a full European ban on Russian oil and gas, and President Biden plans to streamline asylum for Ukrainian refugees. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We need to be careful when we think about a complete European ban on, say, oil imports.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned such a ban would raise oil prices globally and be counterintuitive.
It could actually have very little negative impact on Russia, because although Russia might export less, its price it gets for its exports would go up.
Russian troops continue their assault in Mariupol as Ukraine's president calls for more heavy weapons. The U.S. answered with $800 million of security assistance, including heavy artillery. President Joe Biden also announced a new program to help Ukrainian refugees come directly to the United States.
This program will be fast, it will be streamlined, and will ensure the United States honors its commitment to go to the people of Ukraine and need not go through our southern border.
Resettlement groups want more capacity for permanent protections. The 21 states suing the Biden administration over the end of Title 42 on May 23rd seek a temporary restraining order to prevent it. The policy allowed for a rapid expulsion of migrants at the border due to COVID. In an 8-1 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected an appeal from Puerto Rico residents seeking access to government benefits as American citizens. The ruling noted Congress could extend Social Security to residents of Puerto Rico and other territories if it chose to, but the Constitution does not require it. The U.S. Army is improving health care and the transition back to duty for new parents. A new directive includes new lactation accommodations, a one-year exemption from physical fitness standards, and leave for a soldier and spouse after pregnancy loss. Major Sam Winkler says it's the start of a much-needed culture change.
Normalizing pregnancy and postpartum and recognizing our female warriors as a member of our team and allowing women to come back stronger will really get us such a huge return on investment that this is something we have to do for the future of our force.
About 18% of soldiers are women, and fewer than 6,000 are pregnant at any one time. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has reportedly not ruled out a third White House run in 2024 if President Biden declines to seek a second term. Sanders, an independent, will be 83 on Election Day 2024, while Biden will be approaching 82. Former President Donald Trump, who has not officially announced a run, would be 78. During a speech to conservative activists Thursday, Trump pushed back against Democratic leadership.
The Biden administration should be quickly reversed by a new Congress, and every policy of the Trump administration should be immediately restored.
And Elon Musk has lined up $46.5 billion to beef up his bid for Twitter. He's also considering taking his offer straight to the company's shareholders to sidestep the board. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The U.S. government plans to let out water from the Upper Klamath River Lake to help farmers downstream in a drought. The Klamath tribes are weighing legal action to prevent this, citing ongoing mismanagement of the watershed. With that story and more, it's Shirley Jihad with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Shirley Jihad, in for Antonia Gonzalez. In Oregon, the Klamath tribes are considering legal action now to stop the release of Klamath River water to farmers downstream. The tribe opposes the U.S. government plan to release water from the federally run reservoir, the Upper Klamath Lake. Severe drought in the area has been ongoing for 3 years and exacerbates the competing demands for water, farmers, fish, and tribes. Even with the water release, farmers are getting 15% of what they would normally get. Last weekend, officials released water from the reservoir to the river to bolster salmon populations already devastated by parasites that grow in low, slow-moving water. But tribes say that's half the normal amount. Suckerfish and salmon have been dying out because of the lack of water from the reservoir to support the health of the Klamath River. Klamath tribes blame the current water crisis on what it calls 120 years of ecosystem mismanagement at the hands of settler society. Calling it the rebirth of a nation, Chippewa Cree tribal leaders welcomed the birth of the first bison in more than 20 years. The Rocky Boy Buffalo Project announced the birth of the bison calf this week and released a video showing the newborn wobbling and standing and nursing. Bison haven't roamed the Rocky Boy Reservation in north-central Montana since the early 1900s. In the 1800s, white settlers, traders, and trappers killed millions of bison. Also, the U.S. military ordered the slaughter of bison to devastate native communities dependent on the animal for food, clothing, shelter, and cultural ceremonies. Last fall, the tribe celebrated the placement of 11 bison on the Rocky Boy Reservation, thanks to gifts from conservation organizations and other tribes. The Chippewa Cree sustainability leader, Jason Belcour, tells the Great Falls Tribune, "With this birth, we are witnessing the rebirth of a nation." After days of veto speculation, Maine's governor signed a bill that significantly expands sovereign control over water regulation for the Passamaquoddy tribe. The new law eliminates barriers set up in the 1980 Maine Indian Claims Settlement Act, which treated tribes like municipalities rather than sovereign nations. Governor Janet Mills insisted on wording that limits the tribe's control to its own territorial boundary. The legislation returns those sovereign rights that other federally recognized tribes already enjoy. The law was prompted by the tribe's effort to find a viable source of clean drinking water. The requirement they get approval from the state to drill wells on their own land prevented them from moving ahead. The interim head of Michigan State University's Native American Institute maintains the university discriminated against her and did not adequately respond to her sexual harassment complaints about a colleague. MLive reports Christy Poitra responded this week to a motion by the university to dismiss her lawsuit. She says officials continuously exposed her to discrimination, harassment, and retaliation. She is a Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians descendant. She says, among other things, that MSU denied her equitable pay and failed to resolve her interim status for the past 2 years. And she says the university shrunk the budget and even threatened to dissolve the Native American Institute. The University of Oklahoma is elevating its tribal outreach efforts. The OU Daily reports the university hired Tana Fitzpatrick in the new position of Associate Vice President of Tribal Relations. Fitzpatrick is a lawyer and a member of the Crow Nation. With National Native News, I'm Shirley Jihad.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an Earth Day edition of Coast Range Radio. At 6, it's the Children's Hour. Every day is Earth Day. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 44 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly sunny with a high of 65. Today in history, in 1970, the first International Earth Day was held. The holiday is celebrated to demonstrate support for environmental protection. Today, festivities include over 1 billion people in 193 countries. The quote of the day is from former First Lady of the United States, Lady Bird Johnson, who said, "The environment is where we all meet, where all have a mutual interest. It is the one thing all of us share." The total number of Americans collecting unemployment benefits fell to its lowest level in more than half a century. Jobless claims fell by 2,000 to 184,000 last week, the Labor Department announced Thursday. About 1.42 million Americans were collecting traditional unemployment benefits in the week of April 9th, the fewest since February 21st, 1970. This is occurring despite the recession induced by the COVID pandemic. In fact, weekly applications for unemployment, which broadly track with layoffs, have remained consistently below the pre-pandemic level of 225,000. Last year, employers added a record 6.7 million jobs. They've added an average of 560,000 more each month so far in 2022. The unemployment rate hit 14.7% in April 2020, about 1 month after COVID began shutting things down. That rate is now just 3.6%, barely above its lowest point in 50 years. We now have a record 1.7 job openings for every unemployed American. Tourism season is inching ever closer, but a new survey finds women in the restaurant industry have no choice but to leave their profession. They cite unlivable wages and tips and sexual harassment as driving factors, Mike Moen has more in South Dakota.
As the weather warms up, tourists will flock to South Dakota to visit sites like Mount Rushmore, stopping at restaurants along the way. But a new national survey shows women working in this field describe a worsening environment of harassment and wage theft. The findings are from the group One Fair Wage. Half of all women and nearly 6 in 10 women of color said they're not getting enough tips to earn the full minimum wage required by law. And 73% of women report regularly experiencing or witnessing sexual harassment by customers. One Fair Wage president, Saru Jayaraman, says these women have been the face of establishments during the pandemic.
Asking me to enforce these COVID rules, vaccination card rules, mask rules, social distancing rules on the very same people from whom I have to get tips to survive, that is unlivable.
She says harassment includes a customer threatening to not tip unless the server removes her mask to show what she looks like. The group notes while some independent restaurants are improving their wages, many national chains are not. A bill in Congress to raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour faces hurdles amid debate that it could lead to job losses. The bill also would prohibit sub-minimum wages for tipped employees. They get a smaller base pay with the difference covered by tips or the employer to reach the state level. But Jayaraman argues the requirement to cover what's left is often violated. And she says because this group of workers is overwhelmingly women, men working in kitchens or in management can use it to their advantage.
Women who are mostly in the front of the house serving people are so reliant on pleasing the customer that gives power to the managers to say, if you do me a sexual favor, I'll give you certain shifts, I'll give you certain tables that will guarantee you'll make more money in tips.
The federal sub-minimum wage is $2.13 an hour. South Dakota's is higher at $4.55. But advocates say it should join the group of states that have ended a separate minimum wage for tipped workers. The survey was conducted in March with feedback from nearly 400 respondents. Mike Moen, Greater Dakota News Service.
COVID restrictions in some parts of Asia are easing. Officials in Shanghai promised to relax rules that restricted truck drivers from delivering food supplies and trade merchandise today. China relies on some 17 million truckers to deliver products to stores while also connecting the nation's ports with its manufacturing hubs. Shanghai has been under restrictions that confine most of its 25 million residents to their homes. There have been numerous complaints about lack of food and fears that the shutdown of China's most populated city might disrupt global trade. Its zero COVID strategy shut down most businesses starting March 28th. China recently saw its biggest outbreak since the start of the pandemic in 2020. However, its infection rates were low compared with other major countries. The government reported 11 COVID deaths and over 17,000 new cases in Shanghai today. That city accounted for 95% of the 18,598 new cases in China's mainland. The COVID restrictions required multiple checkpoints and virus testing for truckers. That led to long waits, as well as reports that some shipping companies and drivers were avoiding Shanghai. Under the new system, drivers are allowed through if they've had a negative virus test within the past 48 hours, no fever, and a green health code on their smartphone that shows they haven't been to areas with outbreaks. Officials said the Shanghai port is operating normally, but daily cargo volumes have been down about 30%. Authorities are enforcing a three-tier system that allows residents to go out if their area has had no new infections in the past week. They can leave the neighborhood after 2 weeks without a case. Additionally, Hong Kong announced the end of a two-year-old ban on non-residents flying into the city. It is requiring vaccination and a negative COVID test. The Hong Kong travel ban was one of the world's most stringent since it was imposed in March of 2020. Earlier this month, President Joe Biden said evidence needs to be gathered to put Russian leader Vladimir Putin on trial for war crimes related to his nation's invasion of Ukraine. The International Criminal Court has already begun investigating whether war crimes are taking place, and Ukraine has also set up a team to gather evidence. This comes as other acts of mass violence continue across the world, specifically against the Rohingya people of Myanmar and Uyghurs in China. Now we go to a global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gurdov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Thanks, and hello, everyone. In just the past few years, we have witnessed mass violence directed at innocent people in many places. China's Xinjiang province, the Saudi-led war in Yemen, the Myanmar junta's atrocities against the Muslim Rohingya people, and of course, Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Each of these episodes has its distinctive characteristics, but they all violate international law and our common humanity. None of them can be excused by arguments based on state sovereignty, national security, historical analogy, or the sins of others past and present. Crimes of war come in three categories: war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. The victims of mass violence have legal outlets through the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, the International Criminal Court, the ICC, special tribunals, and regional human rights courts, such as the European Court of Human Rights. Thus, the ICJ considered Ukraine's complaint in response to the Russian claim of genocide by Ukraine forces, can you imagine, in the Donbas region. By a 13-2 vote, with the Russian and Chinese judges dissenting, the court ruled that Russia, quote, shall immediately suspend military operations that it commenced on 24 February 2022 in the territory of Ukraine. Russia never attended this ICJ hearing, claiming the court lacked jurisdiction. The ICJ's opinion is binding under the UN Charter, but Russia was undeterred. The US charged that Putin and Russian military forces are guilty of war crimes might go before the ICC. The Swiss lawyer, Carla Del Ponte, who was chief prosecutor in the Rwanda and Bosnian Serb international tribunals, has called Vladimir Putin a war criminal and urged that a warrant be issued for his arrest. Note that the US and Russia have never signed or ratified the 1998 Rome Statute that established the International Criminal Court, but any state that has signed it can refer Russian violations to the ICC, and 39 countries have done so. According to the Rome Statute, Russia's military has in fact committed many crimes, in particular forced deportation to Russia, imprisonment of Ukraine government personnel, use of children as shields, persecution of a population, attacks on civilian facilities, use of prohibited weapons such as cluster munitions, and endangerment of a nuclear complex. The massacre of civilians in Bucha this month raised the question of genocide. Russia may also be found guilty of committing a war of aggression, a charge that cannot apply to a state that has not accepted the International Criminal Court and may therefore require formation of a special tribunal. Interestingly, Russia's charge of genocide in Ukraine got turned around by Ukraine, enabling the International Court of Justice to investigate and rule on Russian genocide. As a state that has ratified the Genocide Convention, Russia has put itself in the untenable position of being a genocide state. The ICJ's ruling in March is a temporary one. The investigation continues, with more and more evidence piling up in civilian bodies and mass graves to make the charge of genocide credible. One option for bringing pressure on an aggressor state is international condemnation. In the UN, Russia was able to escape such a resolution in the Security Council by vetoing it, but it could not prevent a similar resolution from passing almost unanimously in the General Assembly. International law, though without enforcement mechanisms, is proving as effective as condemnations. In the absence of use of force against Russia, both law and censuring are important tools. As one authority writes, international law remains one of Ukraine's most powerful weapons against Russia. The law is helping states that agree on little else unify in opposition to the invasion. The law has brought together an unprecedented global coalition of states to oppose the Russian intervention and forge a program of sanctions that will raise the costs of the Kremlin's aggression. As an American, it is not easy to condemn the atrocities of others when the United States has been guilty of mass violence in many places, from the atomic bombings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki to its interventions in many parts of the world. Leaders of great powers, however, rarely appear before the bar of justice to answer for their crimes or even have to apologize for them. Nor does calling out the crimes against humanity of others lessen one's own guilt. Still, calling attention to U.S. war crimes cannot exonerate the war crimes of others. All such crimes deserve exposure and, whenever possible, punishment. All national leaders who decide on or acquiesce in criminal behavior must be called to account. The highest purpose of international law is to protect human life and dignity against the power of the state. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 22nd, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, Josh Salem, and Mel Gurdoff. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Shirley Jihad, Mike Moan, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and Mary Sherman. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. It's our spring membership Hive Drive, and now is a great time to support KBOO. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
Alright, hey everybody, thank you for tuning into Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. My name is Andrew. Hey, reach out to us if you got questions, you're enjoying the show, you want to hear somebody.